Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Every day, tens of millions of Americans go to bed hungry or struggle to put food on the table. In spite of all the news about the economic recovery and low unemployment numbers, 1 in 8 Americans, or 42 million people, struggle to get enough to eat. More than 200 food banks and 60,000 food pantries and soup kitchens distribute $5 billion worth of food every year in virtually every corner of the country. And 43 million people are receiving food stamps. So why are so many people hungry in the richest country on earth? Why can't we solve hunger? And how effective have the anti-hunger groups been in addressing the root causes of this crisis? In his new book, Big Hunger, The Unholy Alliance Between Corporate America and Anti-Hunger Groups, today's guest, food justice activist Andy Fisher, praises anti-hunger groups, including tens of thousands of volunteers who work to relieve hunger. But he argues that anti-hunger advocates are missing or ignoring an essential element, and that is economic inequality driven by low wages. He says by relying on corporate donations, anti-hunger groups have failed to confront the big corporations accountable for offshoring jobs, cutting benefits, exploiting workers, and resisting wage increases. He says they've become part of the hunger industrial complex, which today seems as self-perpetuating as the famous military-industrial complex. Andy Fisher is an activist, NGO consultant, and adjunct teacher at Portland University in Oregon. His book, Big Hunger, provides a new vision for how to untangle corporate interests from food banks and the anti-hunger movement. And Andy joins us in studio. Hi, Andy. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Rose. Appreciate it.
Well, great to have you. This is a really important book. It's been largely praised for how you have approached the whole hunger epidemic. But you've also faced some criticism, or some people have criticized you for going after food banks and putting this out there that if you, you're one of your main arguments is that if you team up with Walmart, chances are you're not going to advocate for a living wage.
That's right. I mean, I will tell you one quick story. I was working with a journalist. His name is Steve Holt, who wrote a two-part story on food banking and corporations back in 2013. The first part was a lot about my research at the time, which had to do with the fact that there's a lot of corporate executives on the food bank boards and how that was holding them back from working on minimum wage. That article was published, and the second article was supposed to come out the next day, and it didn't come out. I called him up and asked him why, and he told me that Feeding America, which is the nation's food banking trade association, called up his editor's boss and said, we don't want that article to be run. So takepart.com, which is no longer in existence and is a kind of a liberal, was a liberal blog, censored that article because of Feeding America's concerns. So there's a real example of how groups don't want this dialogue to be happening and have been trying to shut it down.
Why?
Why? Because they're afraid it's going to tarnish their image. You know, food banks have this wonderful image of being mainstream and respectable. They're the go-to organizations for folks who want to address hunger, who have sincere concerns about the plight of poverty and the plight of hunger in their community, and they see it as immoral. And the way that we've been teaching people over the past 35 years or so has been that the way to address this is through charity. And it's not made us any progress for us. In fact, it's caused a lot of collateral damage. So they don't want their image tarnished. They benefit from that very clear kind of shiny image that they have.
Well, let's lay out what we're dealing with here, because we do a lot of shows about hunger and food banks, and we've had on many incredible people who work at food banks around the Bay Area, and they have all said that they are drastically expanding because demand is so high. Is that what we're seeing across the country?
Well, first of all, I think the people who work in food banks are great. I have a lot of friends who do that. And, you know, to me, they're good people who are trapped in a bad system. Mm. So, you know, they are doing the right thing, and they're trying to do the right thing within a system that we've set up over the past 35 years, it's really snowballed out of control. It is not what we intended it to be when food banks were really grew in the early 1980s.
Yeah, talk a little bit about that.
So what happened in the early 80s? There had been, first of all, the first food bank came into existence in the late 1960s by a gentleman out of Phoenix who experimented with kind of consolidating the waste from various places. And he created this model in Phoenix that was expanded and that was built upon in the 1970s. And then when 1981 came about, Reagan was elected president. There was a deep recession at the time. There was a severe decline in manufacturing jobs. I grew up in Youngstown, Ohio, which was kind of, you know, one of the epicenters of the steel industry in the country. And the bottom fell out from that community. It went 30-40% unemployment. Tens of thousands of jobs were lost throughout the community. The community became much more of a ghost town. So at that point, what some labor unions did and churches and other organizations did is they built upon this food banking model as a way to address the immediate needs of the community. And I should say during that time, Reagan also cut back federal food programs, including food stamps. So there was an emergency, you know, a social emergency, if you will. And they built up this system very quickly that grew throughout the 1980s, and it became institutionalized. It became permanent, and it was never intended to do so. It was intended to serve a short-term purpose. And what's happened over by institutionalizing it over this time, we've created something that Robert Lupton, who's an author out of Atlanta, calls toxic charity. We've created a system in which there is a lot of damage to people's dignity and to damage to people's health, and it's really not solving the problem. It's making things better. It's a Band-Aid on what is cancer, essentially.
And this has really exploded. There are more than 200 food banks in the country, 60,000 food pantries and soup kitchens.
And about $5 billion worth of food that is distributed every year.
And 42 million people using these services.
Roughly, yes.
Talk a little bit about how this system exploded from the 80s, a system that was supposed to be – that was supposed to not be here today.
You know, it really grew because it, in the words of Jan Papendieck, who wrote a book called Sweet Charity, on whose shoulders I stand, it met the needs of so many people, and it continues to do so. You know, it continues to be a place where people can feel good about volunteering and addressing the needs in their community. It meets the needs of corporations in reducing food waste. Corporations get a charitable tax deduction for the food that they donate. About $200 million a year is being taken out of public coffers to support those companies. It provides a sanitized approach for poverty reduction. You know, poverty is a very challenging thing for us to work on. It's a very political thing for us to work on. It involves the inequities in society. Hunger does not. Hunger is a symptom of poverty, and by focusing on hunger, we're able to pick apart a very simple solution and enable churches, enable volunteer associations like the Kiwanis, the Lions, and corporations to focus on something that makes them look good, makes them feel good, and does some good in the process. And I'm not trying to say that, you know, food banking or emergency food is a bad thing at all. It's a wonderful thing. I ran a group called Portland Fruit Tree Project for a year, which is a small gleaning organization that picks trees, that picks fruit trees from backyards for people who aren't gonna pick them themselves. And it's I personally have seen how it's a wonderful thing. It really brings people together and builds a sense of community. So there's a lot of good that's being done, but it's a solution. It's a strategy that is no longer a solution. It's a strategy that is not working, and it's a strategy that is causing a lot of harm to public health, to our public dialogue about how we solve the problems in the first place, and it's also causing a lot of damage to the people who go, to the dignity of the people who have to rely on those food banks.
You have firsthand experience because you have volunteered at a food bank. You sort of went undercover to get food from a food bank to talk to clients about this very issue.
Sure. Let me tell you a story. In doing the research for this book, I wanted to volunteer at a food pantry. So I talked to my friends at Oregon Food Bank. I live in Portland. And they referred me to one of the better food pantries in the city. So I started volunteering there. And it's what's called a shopping pantry. So it's not just here's a box of food. It's supposed to confer dignity onto the recipients. It is in a church basement, which is dark and dingy. People go. They get a number. Depending upon the number, they might have to wait a few hours. And then a volunteer helps them around this layout, this church basement layout that looks like a grocery store. And, you know, they're allowed to pick certain amount of foods based upon their family size. So in my orientation from this teenager, she tells me that my role is to be a cross between a personal shopper to help people navigate the system and a security guard, you know, not to allow people to take too much food because it has to be fair. So I am halfway through my first shift. It's about a 4-hour shift. I come upon an elderly couple, and they're looking tired and dejected and despondent. I introduce myself and I ask them their household size. I get a shopping cart and, you know, off we go. So I start to tell them, well, you know, you can take a can of tuna, you can take 3 cans of beans, you can take 6 potatoes, et cetera, right? And as they start to choose their foods, I realize I'm hovering over their shopping cart, you know, watching what they put in their shopping cart. And I'm going, why am I doing this? This is ridiculous. So I take a step back or two to give them some space. And then I realize I'm still, you know, I've got these instructions in my head about being a security guard. And I realize I'm still watching what they put in their shopping cart. And I realize that I felt oppressive. I'm a white middle-class guy. The clients happen to be African-American. And I felt like it's just recreating these centuries of oppression. Mm-hmm. It was one of those things where the power dynamics of the emergency food system were just very much embodied in that situation.
Today, we are speaking with Andy Fisher about his new book, Big Hunger, The Unholy Alliance Between Corporate America and Anti-Hunger Groups. And Andy argues that because so many food banks, food pantries, and soup kitchens receive major donations from corporations like Walmart, they do not fight for a living wage or affordable housing. In fact, he reports that a small fraction of anti-hunger groups actively support increases in the minimum wage. He also says they need to do a better job of mobilizing their clients because it's a massive base. 42 million people struggle to put enough food on the table. And we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on Andy's argument? If you work at a food bank or volunteer at a food kitchen, a soup kitchen, we'd love to hear from you. And if you have been to a food bank and you'd like to talk about what that process is like, has the food bank ever reached out to you to say, hey, would you like to be more involved? What do you think of the process? Are you politically active? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Andy, I'm guessing that a lot of people who don't volunteer or work at a food bank or go to a food bank do not realize just how massive they've become.
No, and I think, you know, partly there's this aura of the local church food pantry, of being, you know, helping out a few people in the community and being a very positive institution. What folks don't realize is, as you mentioned, there's 60,000 of those around the country. And the organizations, it's a very hierarchical structured system where you have at the retail level, at the local community level, you have these 60,000 food pantries. And as you work your way up, there's these 200 food banks. And they've become, in the words of one colleague from who used to run a food bank in Hartford, mainstream, respectable, and rich. They have built budgets of tens of millions of dollars in some cases, and they're distributing millions of dollars of food. They're moving an incredible amount of food because the waste is in the system.
Talk also just about the ties to corporations. You have a graphic in your book showing the various corporations that sit on boards of food banks.
Right. I did. I looked at the employment affiliations of every food bank board member I could find online and making a few phone calls as well. So there's 202 food banks that are associated with Feeding America, which is the main, again, trade association. I was able to find employment affiliation for 154 food banks. So that was 2,817 individuals who sit on the boards of those food banks. And I found that of those 2,800 board members, almost exactly one quarter worked for a Fortune 1000 company. So one of the 1000 biggest companies in the country, you know, either a public or a private equivalent, which is they have revenues of about $1.6 billion or larger. Of those 2,800 board members, you know, it was really hard to tell who was kind of from the community, who was a client, because you just couldn't tell that from their employment. But I did find that only two of those 2,800 people worked for a labor union, and those were both for the same labor, same food bank in Michigan.
You interviewed so many people who work at food banks or who used to work at food banks. What did you learn about what goes on behind the scenes when, say, for example, a minimum wage proposition is on the ballot, or there's a statewide minimum wage law that may or may not be signed by a governor, and they're talking about whether or not they should take a public stand on that?
Right. So I found that, first of all, that very few food banks actually advocate outside of what I call the nutrition safety zone. So food banks, it's very comfortable for most food banks to advocate on public policy issues that relate to nutrition, whether that's the TFAP program, which provides commodities into food bank, or the SNAP program, what used to be called food stamps, or WIC, or school lunches. But once they step outside that nutrition safety zone into areas that are more controversial, whether they're wages or housing or tax policy or, God forbid, immigration, that all hell breaks loose, that they just don't go down that path. In talking to a lot of folks, what I found is that the staff is very progressive. You know, most food banks, especially in places like in San Francisco and California and most, you know, blue states, they tend to be very, very progressive. And they want to do the right thing. They want to advocate on policy. They may not have a lot of capacity to do so, but they want to do so. But when they find that if they need to get approval from the board of directors to do that, they find that the board often shuts them down. And there's some very clear examples of I draw in the book about food banks where the executive director either took a minimum wage policy proposal up to the board and was shut down, or wouldn't do it because she knew she was going to be shut down.
How much influence do these corporations like a Walmart or a Tyson, for example, have on the food bank?
You know, individually, I don't think they have a whole lot of influence, except perhaps a company like Walmart, which is the biggest donor to food banks by far. They've committed about $2.6 billion worth. They've donated about $2.6 billion worth of food and about $260 or $70 million worth of cash during a five-year period, 2010 to 2015. And they make it very clear that if you're going to get money from us, you better not cross us. And they also encourage folks to give them awards.
Andy Fisher is author of Big Hunger, The Unholy Alliance Between Corporate America and Anti-Hunger Groups. And if you'd like to weigh in on this issue, we'd love to hear from you. If you work for a food bank, if you're a volunteer, if you have received food from a food bank, do you feel like a food bank has organized its clients? Andy talks a lot about that. We'll talk about that later in the show. But also taking a stance on policy issues like a living wage or affordable housing, for example. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from Alex calling from the Alameda County Community Food Bank. Hi, Alex. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for calling.
Absolutely. So, Andrew, thank you so much for your book. I literally just completed it last night. And I just wanted to express thanks and appreciation for recognizing Alameda County Community Food Bank's policy work, in particular our community advocates against hunger. A lot of your book addresses the fact that we need to listen more deeply and cultivate leadership with the folks that we're serving. And so we just appreciate the fact that you recognize that as a best practice. And I also wanted to share, a lot of your book talks about the potential innovation within food banking. And so, for example, we recently created a position around community development specifically to tackle the root causes of hunger, you know, whether it's the high cost of living in the Bay Area or racial equity. But our food bank, again, just really appreciates you highlighting this opportunity to innovate and really change the framework of ending hunger.
Alex, can I ask you, what are you hearing from other food bank workers or volunteers? Because what I'm seeing on Twitter by some people across the country, they're saying this is a really tough read, but it's very important information to get out there.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think after reading the book, what resonated with me and what I'm hearing in the Bay Area from other anti-hunger advocates is the need to dialogue, right? Andrew acknowledges in the book that a lot of food bankers and volunteers, recognize, the landscape is really changing politically. And so, for example, on Inauguration Day, our food bank chose to have what we call the Day of Unity in Action, a positive framework to capture that energy, both of our volunteers, our agency members, the staff to be in thinking about, you know, how do we, again, address these root causes of poverty and what new actions do we need to be taking? So,
what do you think about
the dialogue?
Andy's argument that so many food banks are hesitant to support or don't support policies like a minimum wage increase or affordable housing because they're so closely connected to massive corporations like Walmart or Tyson, for example?
Mm-hmm. You know, I can't comment on that, you know, personally. I'm actually relatively new to Alameda County Community Food Bank, having come from a social work background, but I'll say this. Maybe about 4 months into me joining Alameda County Community Food Bank, I received a phone call from someone in the North Bay, you know, asking me about the fact that within her food bank that they were kind of seeing this increased interest and necessity to approach advocacy. And as a member of Alameda County Community Food Bank's policy advocacy, she had reached out to me to, you know, start to get some tips and explore, you know, some of these questions that Andy's raising in his book about, you know, how are we defining the problem of hunger? So, you know, that's what I can share. And again, what I'm hearing from at least, you know, the kind of Western region is, again, this need for dialogue to kind of tackle some of these questions, to share best practices, especially around innovation.
Well, thank you so much for calling in, Alex.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for your time.
That is Alex from the Alameda County Community Food Bank. You did quote quite a few people who work for food banks. Did you get any resistance, Andy?
I got a lot of resistance in the sense of I got resistance mainly from national groups in not wanting to talk to me. Hmm. I know I was shut down by two of the main anti-hunger groups in the country who refused to honor my request for a comment or refused to connect me with employees.
I did notice that Feeding America has a new report out about what's happening across the country. And they do, in the report, mention that so many of the people who come to food banks are working. And one of the reasons why they need extra help or they need food is because they're not making a living wage.
Right.
So they do acknowledge that in their report.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I should really mention that for the first time in about a decade, Feeding America has a CEO that does not come from the corporate sector. Hmm. Diana Aviv is her name. And I've heard wonderful things about her. I've heard she's really trying to shake things up there and really trying to focus on ending hunger, not perpetuating the problem. So, you know, kudos to them. I think she's got a big challenge in front of her.
Well, we have a caller who needs to go soon, so let's go to Christina in San Francisco. Hi, Christina. Welcome to the show.
I always appreciate your program. Actually, just this minute answered my question, which is how many people are actually, is there some statistic on how many people either in San Francisco or in his research nationwide are actually working people? And then a little other question that came up is, you know, different people have different ethnic foods, different even religious things. I mean, it's incredibly important for people to have food. But is there any attempt ever to, be aware and meet those needs as well? I can take my question off the air.
All right. Thank you, Christina.
So, you know, I don't know about the percentage of folks who are going to food pantries who are working. I do know that three-fifths of the people who receive SNAP benefits who are not elderly are in the workforce. So SNAP, or the food stamp program, has become essentially a work support program because our wages are so low. So if we're able to raise those wages up to $15 an hour, for example, a lot of people would not have to rely on SNAP, and we would be able to save some money.
Right. Well, and in this report, as we just mentioned, Feeding America says that so many of their clients are working.
Right. And the one thing I should also add to that is there is a report that the U.S. House Education and Labor Committee released back in 2014. It was like the minority, the Democrats, released this report that found that Walmart's low wages were costing taxpayers $6.2 billion a year in public benefits for SNAP and for Medicaid because they weren't paying their workers enough.
What about Christina's question focusing on the kind of food that is given out, cultural sensitivities?
I'm not familiar with that per se. I do know that there are a lot of efforts within the food banking world to recognize that many of their clients have diabetes, mm-hmm. and they're trying to provide them with, you know, a better diet. There's some pilots that have been going on with the support of a Jewish funder down in Los Angeles called Mazon that are developing kind of diabetes friendly food pantry food boxes for folks.
And also the food that is distributed, it widely varies, because I remember doing a story about older people who went to a very small area, a small room, at it was a community center, and they received things like huge blocks of cheese, canned milk, canned green beans. Most of it was canned. But then if you go to some food banks, they've done really amazing things in trying to bring in produce.
Exactly. Yeah, there's a great program called the Farm to Family Program that's run by the California Association of Food Banks that works with the produce industry. And they're gleaning millions of pounds of produce. So in California, is especially exemplary in the fact that many food banks are distributing 50-60% of what they distribute is actually produce, which is fantastic, because if you think about, you know, what's available in low-income neighborhoods, there's lots of crappy food, there's lots of processed food, but it's often the high quality produce that is not available. So there's a very clear direction among a lot of food banks to moving towards improving the quality of food that they're receiving.
Today we are speaking with Andy Fisher. He is a food justice advocate, and he's the author of the new book, Big Hunger, The Unholy Alliance Between Corporate America and Anti-Hunger Groups. Back in 1994, Andy co-founded and led the Community Food Security Coalition, which was a first-of-its-kind alliance of hundreds of groups working on urban food access and local food. His main argument is that the over 200 food banks and 60,000 food pantries and soup kitchens in this country really need to take a stand when it comes to a living wage and affordable housing. And that is really the only way that we will truly tackle hunger. So what are your thoughts on that? This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
Your call is better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at the show's website. Set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org, and you can also tweet us at yourcallradio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We'll be discussing coverage of the devastating fire at the Grenfell Tower in West London, which killed at least 79 people. This tragedy has turned the attention on deregulation, austerity, and growing inequality in the UK. And then we'll also talk about a year-long USA Today investigation that looks at corruption and the mistreatment of hundreds of truckers in the United States. This is an incredible investigation. It's very long, so I hope you can take some time to read it before we talk to the journalist tomorrow about that investigation. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we're speaking with Andy Fisher about his new book, Big Hunger, The Unholy Alliance Between Corporate America and Anti-Hunger Groups. 42 million Americans struggle to put enough food on the table, and as a result, we have over 200 food banks and 60,000 food pantries and soup kitchens distributing more than $5 billion worth of food every year. Andy says there are amazing people who work at these food banks and soup kitchens, but they're trapped in a very bad system because they're putting a Band-Aid on a big problem. And he argues that what they really need to do is fight for policies like a living wage and affordable housing. He also says they need to organize their clients. And we'd love to hear from you. If you work for a food bank, if you volunteer, if you've ever gone to a food bank, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear next from Elizabeth in Redwood City. Hi, Elizabeth. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you very much. And this is a really important topic. And I wanted to speak about my experience in a local food bank, and also a little bit about the health issue. I had to start going to a food bank, working, but I lost my child support and overnight and couldn't buy food. So I'm well educated, grew up middle class, but I didn't have access to food. I'm in San Mateo County, and in order to get to a food bank, you have to go through the county services. And it is very disturbing because everybody's all together in a huge room, and people with, you know, mental health issues and drug addiction issues who are not getting services, and there are children there because, you know, there's no privacy or a place to accommodate people. There are a lot of working people and a lot of people who appeared to be former workers in the tech sector here. So there are all different people were there. Now, going through and the access that you get to the food, we're very fortunate to have access to produce, fresh produce that wasn't, some of it was restricted. The wonderful volunteers would hand it to you, and some was unrestricted. I eventually couldn't go to the food bank anymore because of the overall low quality of the food. The sugar, corn syrup, badly packaged foods, overwhelmingly, you know, refined carbohydrates. And so my situation improved enough where I could stop going. But there are good people out there doing wonderful things, but it's maintaining a system of, you know, you feel humiliated. You could feel humiliated if you allowed yourself to go there.
Elizabeth, what changes would you like to see?
Well, we would have to make a big change as a culture and a country about how we think about poor people and how they get poor. And, you know, really challenge the myths around poverty and poor people and why they're poor.
Right.
And that attitude, I was in a middle class family, but I grew up in poverty for much of it. We had to depend on food stamps, thank God. But a lot of the attitude is, you're poor, you messed up, something's wrong with you, and you deserve to be punished. Instead of, let's get together and pull together to help each other.
Yeah, it's such a good point. Thank you so much for calling, Elizabeth, and sharing your story. And in Andy's book, Big Hunger, you spend a lot of time writing about this, the, quote, good poor person, the bad poor person. And you write that food banks consciously focus on child hunger and use the faces of children because it's the safe route.
Right. You know, there's this kind of what your caller referred to as kind of this idea of the deserving poor and the undeserving poor. And it's something that goes back to our puritanical roots back in the 1600s. The undeserving poor, those people, as she mentioned, who might be, you know, are considered to be lazy or immoral or shiftless or what have you. So it's much more difficult in this country to focus on supporting those folks because they're seen as, you know, having made bad decisions and they're not as worthy as assistance, whereas those that are perhaps children or the elderly or maybe even veterans are those who are considered the deserving poor, who we should help, who are poor of no fault of their own. So, you know, what anti-hunger groups have done is they've cherry-picked. You know, they've cherry-picked children as the focus for their efforts. You know, who doesn't get motivated by a picture of a smiling child or eating an apple or, conversely, a sad, you know, doe-eyed girl who looks needy? We've all seen those things, and they're very emotionally manipulative to us, and they work. Anti-hunger groups have found it much more expeditious to go down the kind of the politically downhill route of focusing childhood hunger. But when they do that, they sell out everybody else.
And the undeserving and the deserving poor, this is an issue that is constant in this society. How do you think these anti-hunger groups should tackle this issue?
It's a challenge, you know. I mean, I think folks need to recognize it's a slow transformation, but need to start focusing on everybody and not need to start focusing on the universality of this. There's a great organization in Los Angeles called LA Kitchen that is focusing on senior hunger, and its director is this gentleman named Robert Egger, who's very much a visionary in the field. And he used to run a similar organization in Washington, D.C. called D.C. Central Kitchen. And his take is, you know, I want to serve the undeserving poor. He deliberately wants to focus on those who society calls the cast-offs.
Elizabeth was also talking about the personal experience and feeling humiliation. And in your book, you have some phrases from people who've gone to food banks describing the experience. They use the words undignified, racist, classist, toxic, stigmatizing, a slow death of the soul.
Absolutely. You know, I consider charity a death by a thousand cuts. You know, it's something you don't want to be doing. I went in. After I volunteered, I decided I needed to be a client. And, you know, I am a middle-class person. I do not rely on food pantries generally for my food. And so I decided to experience this. I went in, and it was humiliating. I went in, and it was a shopping pantry, which is better than getting handed a box of food. But, you know, I had brought paper bags because I figured I needed some bags to bring my food back. And I was admonished by the volunteers there that next time I come, don't bring paper bags. And the tacit assumption there, or the not-so-tacit assumption, was that I'm coming back.
Well, thank you again for calling, Elizabeth. Today we are joined by Andy Fisher. He is a food justice advocate. He's been working on these issues for years. And he's out with a new book called Big Hunger, The Unholy Alliance Between Corporate America and Anti-Hunger Groups. Let's hear next from Stacy in San Francisco. Hi, Stacy. Welcome to the show.
This is AC. Thank you for taking my call. I come from a very strange place. I used to work corporate America, had a great job, became disabled. So I have a different look on things in regards to where my life has been. And so when I was not able to work and things of that nature, I wasn't able to pay enough to pay for food. So I start going to a couple of food banks here in the city, some of them run by Marin Food Bank. And some, I don't know where they're getting their food. However, a couple of them, in terms of your guess, what they had said was correct. Even at the churches, you feel humiliated by some of the people who work there. They yell at you. They don't talk to you like a normal person. And even within the lines that you're waiting in with some of the people, which are a combination of Latino and Russian and various Asian groups, there's a division within those groups as you're waiting in line to get waited on, that people kind of get really kind of racist in line. Last week, one lady from Russia was screaming at some lady about being Mexican because she was smoking her cigarette. It became this whole racial thing. Then when you get in line, they yell at you because they don't know how to talk to you. You think by yelling louder, you're going to understand what they're saying. And then a couple other places where I've been, the volunteers at another church in San Francisco near Safeway, the volunteers are not trained to deal with cultural competency or cultural humility. They yell at people. They scream at you. They tell you, don't get so excited. It's not the end of the world. You only can take one. And they just, instead of telling you what the procedures are, they just yell at you when you do something wrong. Then they tell you some of the procedures, but yet they yell at you about the procedures. So what my issue is, I don't need to be humiliated when I go someplace. And also the issue for me is, as a person who has some education versus non-education, the people who are not able to communicate are being treated as if they're a non-human. Because people have very little English abilities that come in these lines. And so they need to have either interpreters or get better volunteers who can help navigate and have a smile on your face when you're serving people. Because if you're coming in with a mad, ugly face as a server, people are going to respond in that same way. So this is some of my experience, at least four places I've been to.
Wow. Stacy, thank you so much for calling. Andy, did you talk to food bank workers and volunteers about this?
I did a little bit. And I found, you know, I just by way of example, I found the Stop in Toronto, which was kind of a food pantry. It was a food pantry in kind of a down and out part of town where they totally transformed the way they do business. They started out just as this caller suggested, and they made the environment more appealing to start off with. They painted it. They cleaned it up. They started serving better food. They realized that they, to give people more dignity, they started to call their clients members instead of clients. They fed them before they got food because they realized people were hangry. They were coming in, you know, kind of feeling pretty tough. Mm. And that calmed things down. Mm. I went to visit when I was in Toronto a few years ago, and it was a wonderful environment. Everybody's enjoying lunch together, very peaceful and calm, and they provide a whole lot of other services and help people work with the clients on advocating. But that's a relational. It's about building relationships with the individuals. All too often, our emergency food system is transactional. It's about just, here's a bag of food, take it, get the hell out.
In case people working or volunteering at food banks might want to make some of these changes, what advice would you give them? How did this food bank in Toronto do this?
You know, it was by the leadership of the director. His name is Nick Saul. He wrote a great book called The Stop. I would encourage folks to pick it up, and I think it's a great manual for how to take a pantry that is struggling into a very vibrant place.
And are the food banks in Canada as connected to corporations as the food banks here?
Yes and no. There's not as many. It's not as entrenched. They don't have a tax credit as they do here. Hmm. But, you know, there is unfortunately, a thriving food banking community there. There's more opposition because people have more of a sense of the importance of social assistance, of welfare programs.
Thank you again for calling, Stacey. Let's hear next from Stephanie in San Francisco. Hi, Stephanie. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. And Rose, it's so nice to hear your voice again. I missed you very much.
Thank you.
Yes. I would like to ask your guest to comment on this. I am well-educated, worked my whole life. I became disabled, and I was became very low-income and in food-depleted. And needed to go to a food bank. So a social worker recommended a food bank that I go to, which was in a very high income zip code. And when I started going there, I was amazed. The workers were gracious. The food was incredible that I was offered. Then this particular food bank changed its policy. And besides just showing San Francisco residency, they wanted to see the neighborhood I lived in. So I could no longer go to this high-income zip code food bank. Mm-hmm. I was directed to one in the Mission. And this really goes to the deserving and undeserving poor comment Andy made. Because when I got to the food bank in the Mission, the quality of the food was so much worse. I was treated so poorly, and also people who were getting food there were selling some of the food two blocks down the street to people who were walking by. So I just found that terrible, and I would love to hear what Andy has to say.
You know, that's unfortunately the structure of the system where it's charity, and there are no rights to charity. You know, people give you based upon what they consider to be their rules. So it's very normal for food pantries to limit how many times a person can go back to them or to set their boundaries or their limitations on who can come to them. That's unfortunately a fairly normal structure. What I would have to say about the people selling food, you know, I haven't heard of any place other than this, other than San Francisco, and I've heard it mentioned to me a few times by other folks. And to me, it's, you know, those are people who are trapped in a bad system. You know, they don't poor people need cash, and they don't have a lot of ways to make cash. And if they're going to make $3 or $4 or $5 off of that selling that food, that will help them buy gas or help them pay their electric bill or buy toilet paper, because that's not what they're getting through the food stamp program. So the system is set up and just structured to benefit many other people. But it's, you know, the poor people are merely the pass-throughs of the system.
As you say, people need cash and people need higher wages. And have you spoken with food bank advocates who are planning to be more outspoken about public policy issues? I mean, what would it take? Because as you say, we're talking about so many people. 42 million people need food or help with food. We've got 200 food banks, 60,000 food pantries and soup kitchens. This is a force.
It's a force, and let me give you one example of an experience. I was at an anti-hunger conference in Tucson a few years ago. This is during the Farm Bill debate, so when it was kind of a hot topic whether the SNAP program was going to continue within the Farm Bill or not. And the interim director, president of Feeding America, stood up and said, and you know, said in a very congratulatory, self-congratulatory way, "We just got 5,000 calls into Congress about protecting the SNAP program." Everybody cheered. I went, "Wow, that's a lot." You know, I've done a lot of policy advocacy around different programs, and 5,000 calls is not insignificant. But then I started doing the math in my head, and I go, "Oh my God, there's 200 food banks. That's 25 calls per food bank. There's 60,000 food pantries. That's one in every 10 food pantries is making a call. This is not a lot. Mm-hmm. This is not the NRA. People are not mobilized, and it's a huge potential force." I talked to my friends in the labor movement, and they salivate over the potential of working with the anti-hunger community and working with SNAP and food bank recipients because of the potential organizing ability of mobilizing these people. And the world, this country would be vastly different if food banks put a lot of time and energy into doing that rather than just direct service.
In addition to fighting for a living wage and affordable housing, for example, what about subsidies and how those are distributed? Because you make other great points in your book about the obesity debate. And you argue that what we really need to be talking about is food subsidies. And why is it that, I mean, we hear this a lot, the organic salad is more expensive than a burger, for example.
Right.
And or soda.
Yeah. And I do write about this, for example, where the federal food program dollars are going. There's about $90 billion or so of federal food program money, if you include the school lunches and WIC and SNAP program. That money, by and large, is going into the pockets of big corporations such as Walmart, Kraft, Tyson, et cetera, et cetera. If we were able to direct an increasing percentage of that money into the pockets of small and medium businesses, into the pockets of small farmers, into farmers markets and other types of venues, we would transform the food system in this country. There's lots of great examples around that are doing that, such as the Farm to School and what's called the Finney program, the Market Match here in California.
Thank you again for calling in, Stephanie. We have time for one more call. Let's go to Lisa in San Francisco. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I just wanted to mention the fact that the hunger situation and the non-livable wages is directly correlated with the reduction in union jobs. And unions play a really major role in keeping our living standards and our economic security. And unfortunately, there's this idea that somehow or another people that have unions are living the high life and are separate from the communities that are suffering hunger. But we're part of the same communities, basically. Unions also play a really major role in trying to alleviate hunger and by fighting for livable wages and to keep our health benefits and things like that as well. So I think it's like your guest says, it's all interrelated. And the fact that corporate America has sort of like inserted itself into the hunger problem without wanting to actually look at the root of the problem, which is a disorganized workforce. And Walmart is like notorious for not wanting their workers to unionize as well.
Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you. And, you know, I just wanted to bring up one example of a way we can work around that issue. And that is in Los Angeles, there's a group called the Center for Good Food Purchasing, and they worked with labor advocates in Los Angeles to convince LA Unified School District, which serves 750,000 kids lunch every day, not to be buying Tyson chicken anymore. Mm-hmm. Because Tyson is not unionized and has a whole track record of farmer and worker abuses, but to be buying chicken produced in labor shop and union shops. So they did that, and it was a fantastic organizing effort, and that's the kind of thing that really needs to be repeated all across California and across the country.
Yeah, and you're so right, Lisa. It is all connected. In fact, you'll hear about this on tomorrow's show when we talk about the truckers who are outsourced to drive all the goods that people buy from the Port of Los Angeles to all of the big box stores. And they are going broke because they have to buy their own trucks. And so it's totally connected because a lot of these people go to food banks. And you have some other examples of food banks that are doing it right in your opinion. Can you give us a few more of those?
Sure, sure. And as Rose is mentioning, there's a lot of, you know, there's a real transformation in the food in the food banking community. There's a lot of great people are moving in the right direction. Oregon Food Bank does a lot of great work on advocating for minimum wage and housing. They do great work with rural communities on building their assets. In Rochester, New York, FoodLink lets local entrepreneurs use their space to create their own businesses and use their transportation infrastructure. In the Food Bank of Northern Alabama, it loans money to farmers to help build their businesses. A lot of food banks across California, especially in Santa Cruz and Santa Barbara County, are doing fantastic work, really transforming the narrative and transforming the dialogue. They're really focused on health promotion rather than just hunger relief.
What changes would you like to see to the big food banks that are closely connected to companies like Walmart?
You know, I think the food bank community needs to set a strategic plan, a long-term strategic plan that, you know, it's going to take us a while to get out of this, but within 20 years, let's just pick a date, 2037, we are going to make food banking obsolete. We're not going to be doing it the same way we've been doing it as we are now. We're not going to be distributing food to individuals, but we're going to be doing it to institutions like social service agencies, schools, and the like. And that if we are distributing any food, it's in case of natural disasters, true emergencies, and with comprehensive services that enable people to get out of poverty rather than just a transaction. There's obviously milestones to get us down that path, but ultimately that's where we need to hold that vision in our heads instead of just continuing down the path and burying our head in the sand.
Because you point out, since 1995, when the government began to keep stats, food insecurity has remained largely unchanged from 12% in 1995 to 12.7% of the population. That's a massive percentage today.
It is. And, you know, things ebb and flow. Food insecurity ebbs and flows based upon our economy. But overall, we're treading water. And we need to develop new strategies.
Andy Fisher is author of the new book, Big Hunger, The Unholy Alliance Between Corporate America and Anti-Hunger Groups. Andy, thanks for your work. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Rose. My pleasure.
Thank you. And thank you so much for all of your phone calls. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. This week, we'll discuss coverage of the fire at the Grenfell Tower in West London, which killed at least 79 people. It's raising a lot of issues about inequality in the UK. We'll also discuss a year-long USA Today investigation into corruption and the mistreatment of hundreds of truckers in the United States. That is tomorrow. Your Call is produced here at KALW. To listen to past shows, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Sanaa Saleem produced today's show. And today is Laura Flynn's last day with us. I always say that our producers deserve far more credit and attention. Laura has spent 2 years with us coming up with show ideas, booking guests, which can be incredibly time-consuming, putting run sheets together, and answering your phone calls. And Laura has brought so much to our show. Her ideas, passion, sense of humor, and her friendship especially will be missed. Thank you, thank you, thank you, Laura. And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.